Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 2015 AML Conference Mormon Poetry Slam. This is the very first event, live event of its kind. I've run an online Mormon Poetry Slam before. Go home, Google it. You'll probably find me. I'm the only guy out there doing that. So, welcome to this. Yes, thank you very much. I'm Tyler Chadwick. I will be your MC for this event. How many of you know what a poetry slam is? Some of you might, some of you might not. A little different than just the academic reading. Poets aren't just going to get up here and read it. There will also be judges. The Poetry Slam is a competition invented in the 1980s by a construction worker named Mark Smith, in which performed poetry is judged by five members of the audience. This time we will only have four judges, so take that as you will. Poets have 2 minutes and 30 seconds to present their original work. If they go over the 2 minutes and 30 seconds, we will hook them from the stage or otherwise put them to silence. Take that however you will. The judges will then score the piece anywhere from 0 to 10, 0 being that was crap, 10 being, man, that was awesome, that was floored. Evaluating such qualities as performance, content, and originality. So those are the things you're looking for, judges. Performance, content, and originality. The high and lows, well, we won't do that. Points are deducted. Well, no points will be deducted. Again, you'll just be yanked from the stage. Have fun with it. Don't stress, darling. It will be great fun. Now, we beseech the judges to remain unswayed by the audience. Audience, do your best to sway the judges. And score each poet by the same set of criteria. So, all of you should be thinking exactly along the same wavelength. Yeah, right. Ignoring whatever boisterous reaction your judgment elicits. Audience, let the judges know how you feel about the job they're doing, but be respectful in your exuberance. No profanities or anything like that. There could be no show without them, so now let me introduce you to your judges. This is R.A. Christmas, distinguished poet, written many, many, many poems. And let's see where my other judges.
I didn't get your name. Mathias Westwood.
Mathias Westwood? He's... librarian. He's a librarian. That's great. So he knows books. And we have...
Melissa Young.
Melissa Young, who writes for... I always say it's Segula. Apparently I've been saying it wrong. Segula. However you want to say it. Dennis Clark, in the back, long distinguished member of the Mormon letters community. So those are our four judges.
Thank you.
Now, without further ado, we will get to the excitement of the first live poetry slam. We will start off with, by a completely random person who responded to my email first, actually, Steve Peck will be going first.
This is my first slam, so I'm really excited.
Are you floored or slammed?
I'm slammed. Okay, a little context. This is from a poem cycle about a soldier that's following Alexander around Greek. So, can I say stuff like that in a slam?
Okay, yes. When I snap, that's when your 2 minutes, 30 seconds start. Okay, go.
I look at you on the stony ground amid tufts of patchy grass that playfully worship the god of wind, like children dancing to Apollo or in honor of a king. Your hands rest beside you, curled as if forming a cup, waiting for some offering of wine or perhaps a coin. A Persian spear has pierced your soft eye, opening a slit wide and deep. The point of the blade must have been dulled when it finally reached the back of your helm, emptying your skull forever of thoughts. I did not know you well, a little. I remember once when we were both wine-addled, raging in the heat of lust and roaring through the streets, singing loud and manly that our names would live forever. That was the dream, that like Achilles, our names would live forever. We said it again as we rode together against the cold Aegean wind, side by side, feeling the hard beat of the leather drum deep in our bones. Our names would live forever. But here is the last truth. I cannot remember your name. You are there on the ground, tossed hard by fate, and your enemy's spear. I know your wounded face, but that name by which your mother called you to dine and by which your father commanded you to mind well the sword and spear and its dance has fled me as if you were a stranger. Our names were to be remembered forever, commemorated for deeds worthy of songs. Epic poems were to be spoken of Arete at games and sacrifices, but the wind stirs me to wander on and collect with the other survivors to the place we are gathered to march in another fight, and on in an endless cycle of battles played out in a theater enacted for the amusement of the gods. As I walk away, I try once more to remember your name, but it is gone, and I will try no more. Your bones will dry here, unmarked, unmourned, forsaken.
Good. 2 minutes, 15 seconds. Good benchmark, right? So that was Steve Peck. Give him another round of applause.
Yay, Steve.
Yes, finger clap would also be appropriate. If this were a true slam, it would all be finger clap. Next up, Marianne Hales Harding.
The luxury of breathing. Tipped back again too far, the familiar panic of body craving air, blood rushing, stars littering the peripheral vision, pushing out as a new one emerges, crashing frantically against the tender film of the eyes, searching for the exit, lungs gasping in desperation and regret, thrashing made fruitless by the force of the water, the brain pressing against the skull, tectonic plates shifting, primed to confess any crimes, to reveal any secret. I'm guilty, I admit I am guilty. A million mistakes led to this moment, where nothing can expunge the water, nothing can pull back the tongue, nothing can restore the tiny burst capillaries around the eyes. Air may replace water, but the mind keeps drowning, the stars keep swirling. When ragged breath returns, it takes tentative steps, ashamed of its failure, and ready to retreat again.
That was under a minute, so we're good there, too. All right, next up we have Jessica Dixon.
I'm nervous, you guys are scary.
Tough crowd.
There are mornings when daylights and to-do lists play tug-of-war with my dreams. My internal clock rings as it's time to get up, but in my subconscious reality, there's still hope for us. So I inhale your image like it never left my eyelids and relax my limbs into the sheets that cradle our friendship. In sleep, your embrace still holds up the air in my lungs, my head still swarms with constructions of our future fates, my heart still can't fathom days where it's broken. Memories are stuck in bittersweet replay, echoing days where flirting was as simple as origami. Like when you throw a paper airplane my way filled with pink confetti. The tiny pieces rain on the floor, leaving trails of playful tease. Your eyes smile in front of years of pent-up fond feelings, and every nerve in my body urges you to take that leap. With my romantically brainwashed amygdala manipulating the story, you do. Our lives move forward with swift imagination, building days where being together is comfortably accepted. Your loyalty at my side is not to be questioned. Our friendship is a lovely act we could play forever. But daylight wins somewhere between, this is too good to be true, and pinch me. With every blinking stretch in reality, I remember, we're not talking. We've been reduced to nothing, a memory at best. In sleep, I can afford to live in the past, but the rigid grasp you have on my reason is haunting. My mind whirlpools with thoughts of, your mom wants us to be us more than you do. Our friends want us to be us more than you do. I want us to be us more than you do. And until I can dream something new, it's like the frustration is fresh. So today I pull my cheap cotton sheet over my head as the final white flag. I make it a policy to never give up on dreams, but I'm putting this one to bed. And you see, there's the problem.
Thank you, Jessica. Next up, we have Sean Bailey from the back. wearing a soccer jersey.
That's right. I'm here to keep.
He's here to throw down.
Hi, everybody. This is called the Virginian. Who doesn't shudder holding a pound of butter? The one with the Indian on the cover? Holding another pound of butter, identical, only smaller, depicting another Indian holding yet another pound of butter. An infinite regression of Indians the size of G.I. Joes and grasshoppers and microbes, hawking quantities of butter suitable only for pieces of crisp wheat toast you can smell and you can taste, but that are invisible to the human eye. I was a college boy. The worst thing about being an English major is the poetry. Having to read it and offer criticism at a ratio of 3 compliments for every suggestion. This woman called Angie got up and read a poem called The Virginian, a grainy tableau starring her biker boyfriend Don, his greasy ponytail, and their weekend in Jackson Hole. The Virginian is a hotel. It's a motel. Angie and Don didn't do much skiing that weekend or hiking the Tetons or rafting the Snake. I still remember her description of the bed frame and the curtains, coarse polyester, off-white with carrot orange medallions, heavy with the cigarette smoke and dander of a million tourists. And the contortionism, so many positions. The spring-loaded hinge, she called it. The inverted cat burglar, I think. The praying mantis. It was like walking in on my parents, if my parents were middle-aged black leather bikers called Angie and Don. And the door getting jammed shut behind me. I said I liked the title and the bed frame, and especially the curtains. I said the rest was somehow too specific. I pulled into Jackson this morning a decade later and more. There is the Virginian, and here I am, captive again. So I'm writing this down. Because someday you might go to Jackson. You can't miss the Virginian. You will remember the Angie and Don Heavy Metal Kama Sutra. The door behind you will not budge. And you will tell someone who will tell someone who will tell someone else. Maybe you will even write a poem about it, giving birth to an endless regression of squirming, involuntary voyeurs. Each of us more or less identical, only smaller.
Thank you, Sean, for throwing down. That was great. Next up, Bonnie Schiffler Olson.
Okay, I'm going to be performing Universal Surnames, an elegy for Argo Navis, written on the advent of my 6th last name. Today, I'm an ember of yesteryear's burn. Or perhaps there is never enough oxygen in a room. Stars are an assumption, waiting on time we don't have, to spend waiting around for outcomes. Maybe the edge of the universe is rushing toward us. Maybe this is speculation. Like the great-great-grandfather, no one is certain, disappeared into the Yukon. Like the 6 children he left somewhere in between Idaho and Arkansas. Like the 6 names you learn to identify yourself, like the dizzying line of a fly trying to escape into the flecked night sky through the window pane. This map is a renaming too. A shifting star chart, like an eraser chasing lead through a dot-to-dot landscape, like the pictures our children give us to wallpaper the refrigerator, then reupholster the landfill, then mulch the ground where we will lie and they will lie, until the story of connection is a picture of bone meal and ash, and dust, and unlikely starlight.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Next
Next up is the reluctant participant, Darlene Young. No, don't worry, Laura's next. So.
The guys I didn't marry. The guys I didn't marry have hairy backs and need to lose a few pounds. They never vacuum their cars. They have peanut allergies. The guys I didn't marry look pretty good for their age. They dream about flying or about eating meatballs. Every 7 years or so, they dream of me. The guys I didn't marry have become DJs and live in their parents' garages. They forget to take their meds. Regularly, they stub their toes on the porch step. The guys I didn't marry run a marathon every year. They skinny dip at Lake Powell with their lovers. At least 6 times in the past 2 years, they've experienced moments of unbearable happiness. The guys I didn't marry thank their lucky stars they didn't marry me. Most of them think they broke my heart or that they never really loved me after all and were just caught up in the moment. Some of them married the next girl they kissed. The guys I didn't marry have a hard time throwing away their ratty underwear. They ignore current events. They wait in line. Some of the guys I didn't marry wept at the end of The Lord of the Rings. At night, they stare at the ceiling. Most of them can't understand their fathers-in-law. The guys I didn't marry pull out moldy drywall after they discover the slow leak. They whistle while they work, mostly Oingo Boingo, but sometimes Phil Collins. They do the cooking, but they don't wash the pans. They take their wives on cruises, they fly kites with their daughters, and their golden retrievers run in the sun and bark with joy. All of them have low back pain.
Thank you, Darlene. The reluctance and the anxiety have passed. That was great. Laura.
This one is called Ode to My Comfortable Pants. You're not much to look at, you comfortable pants. Tired and worn, twisted and torn, I sometimes don't even bother to fold you. Not like those department store jeans. Those are a sight to behold. In all their dark wash, snazzy seams, shiny button, patented control stitch, front hip-hiding, glute-lifting glory. Weaved into that sweetly stretching fabric is the antidote to every wobbly, weak, wistful, well-intentioned impulse, the opiate of my cellulitic thighs. They promise to get me going in the morning, to get me through my day. They are the cover of my dimpled, stretchy shame, the trademarked mask of fashionable women. With stilettos instead of bootstraps and the mythos of modernity edging out maternity, the primrose path is paved with denim. But you, my comfortable pants, you have no illusions for me or for yourself. There's no squeezing or squishing, no pinching or standing just so. Like an oversized chair tucked in a library corner, you are perfectly suited for one thing and one thing only. To cushion, to hold, to embrace, to accept. You, my comfortable pants, are love.
Thank you, Laura. I forgot to mention that Laura is a reigning online Mormon Poetry Slam champion. So she's sort of upholding some kind of
something.
You know, something.
Really.
She's defending a crown. If our competition mattered anywhere, I guess. Next up, Emily Adams.
Is called There Is No Death With This Blood. There is no death with this blood. No, this blood is only a testament of the life that didn't start. I should not be mourning the loss of a barely imagined, only hoped for her. It's only that there were moments I thought I sensed someone there, when I envisioned the stubs of fingers forming on a blooming hand. New eyes starting to stretch, still sealed lids. Though I know it would have been far too early for more than a sanguine division of cells. This blood is mine, not hers. And it has been coating my womb, not pulsing in my veins. It's been still and cooling for nearly a month. There was no violence, no struggle, no sudden cessation of movement. There is no death with this blood, but she's gone all the same.
All right, our last performer for the first round is Kevin Klein.
This is a short poem, just to give a little context, and you can go ahead and start it because it's short. My wife and I, many years ago, met a woman who was a single mom with four kids, and got to know the kids through the Big Brother, Big Sister program, got to love them, and really got to admire this woman for all she did with what she had. And so this poem is a celebration of one of the family's favorite coping strategies. It's called Allergies for Janet. On Mother's Day, it snows in our backyard, the kind that grows on cottonwoods and makes my nose itch inside the nostrils, pinch half closed at the bridge, yet still drip. And as it blows into the grass, the cotton that is, I see your clothes and the cat hair stuck in them, all those rabbits, ducks, dogs, and cats, which I suppose you never thought about wanting, but chose for your kid's sake. The way a tree knows its seeds will fall, and makes pillows for their landing when the wind throws them out of reach by all but your branches' shadows. Thank you.
All right, that's the end of our first round. Give all the poets a round of claps and applause. Whistle, be exuberant, all that fun stuff. I'm ready to consult with the judges for just a minute so we can decide who moves on to the next round. And just know now, if you do not move on to the next round, that does not mean you are a poor poet. And remember, their names are Bob Dennis. We won't give out their addresses. No.
I'm going to go to the next one. We have come to a conclusion. We don't know what we're doing.
We do not know what we are doing, but we're having fun doing it. We decide we were top five are moving to the next round. The first will be Sean, Laura, Emily, Jessica, and Darlene. Top five, moving on. So now we'll move into the next round. After this round, we will bump it down to two or three, depending on how much time we have left, and then they will go head-to-head for the winner. And you get all the applesauce after that, I suppose, if you want to go to the store and get some applesauce. So we will begin with Sean.
No more heavy metal comic book.
No. Crazy rain here. This is called Mermaids. The suit across the table has teeth so white they probably glow in the dark. The table is plastic, gray, buff, shiny with the oil of other people's hands. The obsolete printer hums and clicks off and on in the business center next door. Another anonymous hotel conference room. Another negotiation over numbers. This is where these guys act big, strut around, puff out their chests, get in my space. So I'm not surprised when he rises to his pointy Italian slip-ons, circumnavigates the table, and picks something off my jacket. I hope your wife has red hair, he leers, holding it up, examining it, long with a gentle curl, conditioner commercial lustrous, the color of Ronald McDonald's wig. I see his leer, and I raise him a wicked grin. That's not my wife's, I say, casually, without hesitation, daring him to ask me more about my jacket follicles and their sordid backstories. What I don't say is that I bathe with mermaids. Three of them, to be precise. The pretty one has a fin that goes on for days. She's light and lithe in the water, but also intimidating, cold. The sweet one has eyes from an ancient tragedy, dimples, and a playful way of floating around on her back. The sweet one's little sister is pudgy, and her stubby fin has sprung a leak, making her swimming labored, inept. All three of them are toy store gingers called Ariel. And I have long since given up on exiling them back to the kids' bathroom. They always come back anyway with the bath time tied. Also, it occurred to me that someday my daughters will only visit occasionally, and I will be here, no synthetic hair on my jacket, mermaid bereft.
I am well acquainted with the bathtub Ariel. We have two that migrate between our bathrooms. Excellent. So, Laura, you're up next.
Keep the nerves flowing.
I don't have a working printer, so I have to read this off my computer. This is awkward. This one is called Christus. When I was small, the ramp felt like forever. Walking and walking, counting the stars, gazing at the planets, and walking and walking. When I got there and the music was playing and the sisters were talking, all I could see were your feet, shockingly big and white with perfect toenails and scars from holes. My heart got big and my throat felt small, and I wondered if you'd mind if, like Nephite children that you held and blessed, could I reach out my hand and touch you? Then there was that day years later when I somehow got wrapped up with a Jewish tour group, one moody Mormon teenager mixing in with more teenagers who kept asking questions like, why is there a Star of David on your temple? And why do you call it a tabernacle? And what does it all mean? And all I could think to say was, because we believe just like you, but in Jesus too. So we went in the tabernacle. The sisters sang, As I Have Loved You, and the Jews sang in Hebrew, and my heart burned, and I cried, and their tour stopped outside the visitor center. They didn't go in, but I did. I hurried up the ramp and gazed out the window, counting the kids as they left. I looked at your hands, stretched out still, like an embrace waiting to be filled, and I hoped that a few might remember that we believed in you and them, too. The last time I was there, I didn't even come up. I'd been there before, I knew what it was. Besides, my friends and I just needed a place to get warm and wait. I think I told jokes and laughed too loud, like I didn't know where I was or who you were, but I remembered where you were. You were up the ramp at the top, waiting just like you do, scarred feet firm and arms stretched open, your words and music filling the space below and beckoning to me. But I didn't go up. I was afraid I might find reproach in your eyes and regret in your hands and your side. I hadn't come in for you, and I knew it, and I figured you did too. I want to come back with my children in tow. I want to sit on buttoned benches with light warm behind me and watch them walk up to your feet. I want to see them look up and reach towards your hands. I want to see the look in your eyes, because then I'll be with them, with you, and it will feel all new, and I'll remember what it is that I know.
Thank you, Laura. Next up, Emily Adams.
Is I can still taste it. I don't remember the time of nameless animals. The lions have been lions too long for even Adam to think of them as anything else. Neither can my feet recall the luxury of thornless, silt-soft ground. The children often ask me to describe the face of the serpent man who came to tempt me, but the details of his jawline, eye color, and skin tone have all rubbed free of my mind, scrubbed away by the thousand faces I've seen since. Others beg for word-painted pictures of the ominous tree, but I could only say I can't remember seeing anything like it before or since. Each arboretum seems to lack a certain half-remembered color. I don't remember much of Eden. The children have to prompt me in the particulars of my own story. My garden has long since and mercifully faded into a myth of soft-gummed carnivores and self-watered wheat. All the details, all the colors, and sharp edges are gone. But the fruit, I can still taste it.
Thank you, Emily. Now, next up, Jessica Dixon.
Time Bomb, and I wrote it during a pretty intense faith crisis. If I have the darting eyes and sweaty palms of a suicide bomber, it's because I carry around a crudely wrapped package made of my own device. You see, my beliefs are a bundled dichotomy, wrapped up in brown paper hypocrisy tied neatly with a string of doublethink. I am a ticking time bomb. That's what happens when you let a culture, a religion, and a life experience all play surgeon with your chemistry set. I have the veins of an electric highway, crisscrossing wires pushing blood to the old ticker. Every day I'm pumped full with more combustible contradictions, and the clock is running down. In Sunday school, I lost 30 seconds when love thy neighbor sounded a lot like save thy neighbor. I lost 25 seconds when being Christ-like looked a lot like being a pompous, prejudiced ass. 12 seconds when I read that research about religion making us happier, more hopeful. 15 seconds when I saw an atheist use his own moral compass. 8 seconds every time I realize a part of me won't make it out of this alive. I've never been good at making decisions, especially when the outcome is destruction. There's no SWAT team for a faith crisis, no matter how protective they think the word is. Do I keep the red charge or the white charge? The reds of the world or the whites of religion? Snip the white wire of religion and watch everyone I love get hurt in the blowback. They'll be picking up the remnants of their confidence in me for years, constantly piecing together what they could have done differently. I'll be freer but burdened with survivor's guilt, occasionally getting grasps of the present to make up for shaming the past. I won't look the same. No one will look the same. Snip the red wire of the world and watch me implode. I'll look the same, but will be a shell of who I want to be, always subconsciously trying to regain my individuality. Everyone will look the same, especially since I blew away all my nerve to disagree. I won't feel the same. I already don't feel the same. 5. Oh, I feel sick. 4. There's no SWAT team for a faith crisis. 3. No SWAT team. 2. What should I do? 1. What should I...
Stay tuned to see what happens. She's still here, so it must not have blown up too much. And last for this round, Darlene. She's already on her way up.
A girl, 15. Better to be wanted than to want. By boys, by girls. Sweet hum of a dress that clings where it should. Better if someone's watching. The cross legs of waiting, dangling a sandal. Being hunted or not, chosen, picked like a lock or a scab. Getting breasts as if I'd won a race. Carrying a telephone, daring myself not to. Sitting in the front yard, my oiled legs in front of me like wares on a cloth. Perky underpants, chilly courting dance. Remonstrance. Entering a room with scanning eyes, pulling straight my hems. I've envied boys, the never stopping to take a breath on the brink of a room like a pool, the easiness in clothes, the breezy way they move down a street, the calm when a car slows near them. No panties in pails, no checking their nails. At what point does a girl learn to look over her shoulder? Watch how she glances down to check her waist. There's no rest. She ends each statement with a lilt. A walking question mark? Even girls who push apologize along the way. Pardon me for living. Always misgiving. Must make a splash, but don't dibble the water. The point of being a girl, a coined preening. The tender gristle of trying ladylike unfurl.
All right, now we come back to the difficult job of judging. So, thank you. Let's give another round of applause to those final points. And we'll consult with the judges, so stay tuned. Cue elevator music.
Are we going down to 3 or are we going down to 3?
We're going down to 3.
Oh, 3.
You do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you
Yeah.
Intense consulting and almost fist fight.
We've come down to our top three.
And they are, drum roll please, Sean. Must be the jersey, brother.
Must be.
Darlene. And Emily. So we will begin, since Sean started the last round, we'll change that up. And we will let Emily start this round.
Walking on water. Two nights ago, as I lay on my bed, I felt the mattress suddenly curve and harden into a wooden boat. The teary wetness on my face slid seamlessly to drench the rest of my tired body. The rough breath of the barely crying left me in one great rush and became the storm that tossed my feather-made vessel. It happened with such fluid senselessness that I did not know I had gone into sleep. All I knew was I was on a boat in a storm and I must get to the shore. There were no oars, none, and I could not swim in the flesh-rending water of the wind-stirred current. I dipped my hands into the surge and tried to paddle myself to safety, but the waves held more power than my arms. I yelled in competition with the wind, commanding its hurricane to stop, but felt only the words blown back into my open mouth. I held up my hands for God to take me, but felt no returning grasp. I would be lost. I knew it. I saw the shore, but I could not get there, not in that boat. With striking clarity, I thought of the one successful man to walk on water, and I remembered the man who had tried and failed. I thought of my own weight and how it should make me sink. It should pull me under the waves, and I knew that here in the boat, at least I did not sink. Oh God, I thought, I do not want to sink. I cannot stay in the boat, and I do not know how to walk on water. I stood crying, terrified. I stepped free of my floating trap and did not sink. My weight balanced on the water, solid and cold as gelatinous ice. In my exultation, I did not see the wave that slapped me off my feet and sent me rolling off the tops of the breakers. I stood again and, gasping, fought against the violence beneath my feet. Blinded by windy rain, battered by waves, bruises bursting beneath my skin, I walked toward my last sure glimpse of the shoreline. Each shift of the water unbalanced me. Each blast of sea spray sucked warmth from my body. Each moment was a battle to move forward, but I was walking on water. Oh God, I thought, keep me above the waves, keep me from falling too deeply. I would not ask, but I could not have moved, not in that boat. It was a fight toward the shore, and in my mind, I wondered and hoped someone might shout, "Peace, be still." When no voice came, I wondered if maybe God wanted me to drown. But I couldn't wonder too long, because hiking up a 15-foot wave took my thoughts as well as my muscle and breath. It took hours, I'm sure, before I felt the telltale signs of sinking, a sense of thickness and heaviness in all my limbs, and the inability to lift my toes. I cried and prayed, sure I was going under. I cried out, Lord, save me, just as I sank to my knees in the surf. Slipping in water down to my waist, I screamed. Then I was jolted by something solid, but shifting under my feet. I heard an answering voice say, sand. And I woke up, crusted with sweat and salt. I walked to the bathtub and washed my feet before I thought to check my toes for grit.
Thank you, Emily. Now we will go with Darlene.
My teenager gets his wisdom teeth out. At first, we giggle at the effects of the gas. You mumbling and drooling through a crooked grin, pawing at rainbows. I want a soundtrack of 60s psychedelic. Cue the mirrored ball. But then you get belligerent. Why won't anyone let... Oh, sorry. Try to stand up. Why won't anyone let you? Batting away the nurse's hand, you try to wedge your clumsy fist into the mouth you cannot feel. Tug on bloody gauze. You yell. I picture now a new potential. You as an angry drunk someday. Your future son hiding under his bed. Or dementia, you at 85, bullying a dutiful daughter-in-law. How fragile our chemistry. Which is the real you, the real me? How precarious our personal universe when one little whiff, one pulse of the button on our chemical blender turns us beast. I gather you up, already a foot taller than me, spitting and thrashing like a two-year-old who hates the car seat. My son, it is as you suspect. I would like to strap you somewhere safe. Padded gondola, float you in gentle rivers for 60 years or so. It's the sin of the fearful mother. Forgive me, my chemistry names you flesh of my flesh. But my hand warm on your arm is a screaming offense. Ah, for now, let's just get you home.
Thank you, Darlene. And now, for the last performance of the day, we have the Jersey Man. This is called I Miss Everything. A paper flag, pocket size, forgotten, flaps surrender in the breeze. Take receipt, the gas pump says to R. Denny, long gone, who put 6817 of premium unleaded on a credit card at 11:18 p.m. I squeegee from my windshield the blood of mosquito hosts, people and dogs and birds. I drive into the night. I give Ardenny a face, a family, a vehicle that needs premium fuel, a sleek feat of engineering with just the right number of cylinders and cup holders, something that looks either beige or silver, depending on the light. I give her an internet persona, this Rebecca maybe, Rose, a bicycle, bad breath, a wallet, and regrets. I appreciate her dignity, the words she leaves unsaid, how she gets over for traffic, letting it pass on the left. Tonight, I wish Ardenny were you, my friend. Decades back, days away by car, surrounded by strangers who didn't help us invade the country club pool after hours, buck naked down the seventh fairway, convulsions of laughter so strong the cops almost ran us down. Who didn't get lost with us that time we backpacked the Escalante in circles, our boots stained rust red. Who didn't help us smuggle into the lazy river a plastic bag pregnant with a live rainbow trout. If you were our Denny, I'd have proof that you didn't just disappear. This slip of paper, 6817 of gasoline, that we stood right there, only minutes apart, and gassed up our cars before you drove to your home, wherever that is, and I drove to mine. All right, big round of applause again for our three finalists. Yay. Now, excuse us while we pick a winner. After the quickest judging round of the evening, we have our winner. First place is Darlene Young. Give her a round. Participation Testament is the reigning champion, so congratulations, Darlene. Let's give all of our poets another round of applause. Give the judges a round of applause. Yeah. Don't boo them too badly. Excellent job. Thank you all for being here, and to support Mormon poetry, please. Hashtag Mormon Poetry Slam. Go find it.